small stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, 1 centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia. I'm your host, Rohit Singla, filling in for Alan Manning tonight. With me in studio are Damien Quinton and Tanya Rusi. Sharing Science Radio is here to bring you a weekly dose of science news, discussion, interviews, and, on occasion, local events. On tonight's show, we're going to examine just how you think. No, not quite a psychology episode. We're going to take a look at science education, how you as students learn, and, well, how teachers teach. And we've also got a special surprise. We have a double whammy of expertise joining us tonight as well. We'll hear from Dr. Natasha Holmes, former Let's Talk Science Executive Coordinator and currently a postdoctoral researcher at Stanford, as well as Dr. Jared Stang, a science teaching and learning fellow with the Department of Physics and Astronomy, as well as the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative. But before we even get there, what's the importance of it? Why research science education at all? Damien, do you want to feel this one?
The importance of having a scientifically literate society can't be understated. As a whole, we need to be able to address scientific issues and participate in discussions on topics like GMOs, genetic modifications, climate change, and vaccines. Topics that can frustrate the scientifically literate populace who let the loud and ill-informed make decisions. A technically literate population possesses complex problem-solving skills. They think differently. They think like scientists. We need our citizens to be able to use science like scientists do. For that, there needs to be a transformation in how students think, and Dr. Carl Wieman believes it's possible to create this change for a large fraction of the population. Dr. Carl Wieman is a Nobel laureate and director of the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative. This is a group devoted to dramatically improving science education here at UBC. He wrote an article, Why Not Try a Scientific Approach to Science Education? It appeared in the September-October 2007 issue of Change. In it, he argues this transformation can be brought about by improving science education as it stands today to treat science education as a science and use research-based techniques to improve current methods. It should, to some extent, come as a surprise that it's not until now that we're talking about this. We've been teaching science, and most subjects for that matter, the same way for ages. A lecturer talks to a group of mostly passive students who go home to work on assignments and come in to write an exam similar to those assignments. Is that the best way to learn? What are the odds we got that right the first time? What are the odds the way we've been teaching large groups of students this whole time was the best method? And how come there's such a wide variation in how instructors teach? Surely, some techniques work better than others, and we should be able to use science to back that up. As a scientific community, we already know a great deal on how people learn. Psychologists and education researchers devote their careers to this study. We can use this research to improve our own teaching methods. We can also use modern technology to advance education research and use objective data to form our teaching practices, rather than tradition, which is too often the case. So what does this kind of research look like? Take, for example, retention. Retention after science lectures is woefully low. Thanks to data collected by education researchers, we have direct evidence of this rather than anecdotes. Most students forget most of the material they learn very quickly. We can create robust and reliable assessments, research tools that probe student learning, and we can make changes to how we teach this material accordingly. Changes such as using clickers, devices where students can answer multiple choice questions live during lecture, and the profs can see right away if students get it. Changes like reducing the cognitive load so students have less concepts to juggle. Changes like using technology to create effective physics simulations, for example, that guide student thinking and drive home concepts more effectively. We can then use these assessments, tools, to measure how much more students have learned. We can quantify how effectively instructors teach and students learn. Treating science education as a science, using evidence-based methods and tools, is the first step in creating a scientifically literate society able to progress in an increasingly scientific world.
Thanks, Damien. Now, let's hear from Natasha, Natasha has both her master's and PhD degrees from right here at UBC, studying in physics education research. Natasha was also involved in professional development of physics TAs and was a conference organizer for Women in Physics Canada. Needless to say, she knows what she's talking about. Being at Stanford, however, Natasha couldn't join us live, but here she is anyways.
My name is Natasha Holmes, and I'm a postdoc researcher at Stanford University, and I did my PhD work at the University of British Columbia in physics education research. We recently published a study demonstrating how to teach critical thinking. What do I mean by critical thinking? Well, it's the questions that you ask and the decisions that you make when you're trying to figure out what's true or what to believe. It's about looking at evidence, deciding if it's correct, if it's good, and then figuring out what to do with it. What does it tell you about the world? In science, this can mean looking at data, figuring out if your data is as good as it can be. Can I get better data? And what does it tell me about the thing that I'm studying? What new questions is it raising? But this also applies more generally in the world when you're reading stories in the news, when you're critiquing other people's research. How do you decide if something is fact or opinion? Is the conclusion that they've drawn the right one based on the evidence that they have? This is very relevant today with debates about climate change, the safety of vaccinations, and all kinds of stuff. So this is the sort of thing that we wanted to teach in our intro physics lab course. Why teach it in a lab? Well, labs are the one place where students are doing experiments. They're getting their own data and supposed to be making sense of it. So it really is uniquely suited to teaching this kind of stuff compared to lecture courses. Most lab courses, unfortunately, are about giving students all of the instructions, telling them what to do, how to do it, and often even giving them the answer that they're supposed to be getting at the end. And this completely removes the whole critical thinking and decision-making process. And lots of students have told me about they just follow the instructions without thinking and they're not really sure what they're supposed to get out of it. I know that was my experience in my labs. So we really wanted to expose this decision-making process and expose the science behind these experiments, the process. So when students got results from an experiment, we would ask them to compare it to something, give it some context. So that could mean take the data two ways and compare them to another group, or compare them to these models and equations that they find in the textbook. But beyond just making the comparison, we then told them to do something about it. So find a way to see if you can get better data was a big part of it, since this really all comes down to how do you decide what to believe? And so you need to think about the evidence that you have. Is it as good as possible? And then beyond that, this became particularly exciting when we were comparing to models or equations in physics. The equations in science, the models that we use, are all approximations. It's always our best way of evaluating or describing the world. But with better data, with better equipment, with better science, you can expose new things. You can expose these approximations and learn more. You can add on them. So for example, Newton's laws were a great way of understanding the world with the tools that they had at the time. But as tools have gotten better, we've been building the Large Hadron Collider and all kinds of fancy equipment. We can expose new physics that was hidden before. Doesn't mean that the old equations were wrong. It's just that they were as good as we could get at that point. So we've got students doing this sort of thing in a first year physics lab. Our favorite example of this is a period of a pendulum experiment that they do the first week of class. And the students are told to find ways to improve their data. And as they get better and better data, they actually expose these limitations and approximations and have to adjust the models that they're being shown in the textbooks. They're doing real science. So what did we find? Well, we gave students support with this critical thinking, decision-making early in the course, and then we slowly faded that over time. And by the end of the course, when all of that support was gone, the students were still using these critical thinking skills far beyond the level of a control group. Students on our course were about 12 times more likely to improve their data or propose ways to change and improve the experiment, and they were 4 times more likely to pick up on these limitations and approximations in their models. The big kicker, though, was that a year later, in a second year physics course, the students were still using these behaviors far beyond the level of the control group. This means it wasn't just something that they were doing in our class, something that had become an expectation or a norm. It was something that they were doing of their own accord. They thought these things were actually useful and important when doing physics experiments in general. And seeing that sort of transfer of these behaviors in time a year later to a completely different course is a huge deal in education, and something that's not often seen in different pedagogies and teaching methods.
Thanks, Natasha. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back after these messages, where we'll join Dr. Jared Stang live in studio.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
Welcome back. All right, so we've heard from our resident experts, Tanya and Damien, but let's turn it over to a real expert, Jared Stang, a science teaching and learning fellow with the Department of Physics and Astronomy and the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative. Welcome, Jared.
Hello.
Hey. Okay, so Jared, tell us a bit about yourself. What's your background? What's your research in?
So my original background is in physics. I did my PhD in string theory. Since then, however, I transitioned into science education and physics education research.
Okay, but what is that? I mean, what are you researching? Break it down for me a little bit.
So in physics education research, we study how students learn physics and how we can teach it to them better.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your particular field of research?
I'd love to, Tanya. So my particular project, I go a little bit higher to a meta level above that. I try and study how we can help faculty learn to be better teachers.
Oh, that's so interesting. How do we do that?
So my particular project is about paired teaching. So that's when we pair two faculty together to teach a course.
Awesome.
Wait, why would I put two members when I can get one for the same price?
Sure, if you're UBC, it sounds a lot cheaper to do just one.
Yeah.
However, it's really just a good professional development opportunity.
Okay, how do you mean, though? Like, I'm just not getting it here.
So maybe the best example that we've had in our department, we had a brand new research faculty member come in a few years ago.
Okay.
And they didn't have any teaching background at all.
So a total noob.
A total noob.
Okay.
Complete noob.
For the record, I said that. He did not, if you're listening. What happened?
So they were assigned as part of a pair to one of these first-year courses, first-year physics, Physics 101, 300-odd students, that giant lecture classroom.
Okay.
And they were paired with someone who has 25 years of teaching experience plus a ton of experience in physics education.
So like the wise old wizard of education here.
Mr.
Miyagi of
Dr.
education.
Miyagi. The Dr. Miyagi.
Dr. Miyagi and
Professor,
Karate Kid.
Professor Miyagi, ladies and gentlemen.
And Professor Karate Kid.
Okay, so what happened? We got these two, and what's the big deal?
So what happened? Well, they talked together for that entire semester. That was a few years ago.
Yeah.
And now that brand new faculty member is a leader in the department. They are continuing to teach first-year courses, and they're doing it very, very well, using the methods that we know work.
Sorry, you said leader in the department. You mean his research, or?
I mean, they're a leader in teaching.
In teaching. Oh, very cool.
So that really accelerated their teaching development from what could have been nothing. Many new faculty come in, and they're given the advice to spend zero time on teaching. Focus on your research till you get tenure. So they came in to a department where they did complete opposite. They focused on teaching immediately. They probably did some research too.
Hopefully. One would hope.
But they were part of this program to improve their teaching, target them right in the first year, and the results are clear. They're very effective now.
It makes intuitive sense that we would train people properly to do part of their job.
Whoa, that's not... Let's keep
not,
it within
I'm
the
not,
realm
you know,
of sanity here,
Tanya. Looking
awkwardly
at all the rest of the professors and departments, but, you know, I am.
Okay, so that's very cool. We pair up people, and that's one interesting point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But what are other ways to teach? What are the best ways to teach?
Lots and lots of research has been done about this, comparing different methods of teaching. And so the control case is always the traditional lecture. That's the sage on the stage. The prof goes to the front of the room. They stand there, sometimes in one spot, for 50 minutes. They deliver. Students sit in their seats. Their job is to sit, listen, sometimes fall asleep, sometimes check Facebook.
That sounds like the most of my undergrad experience. Yep. Okay.
That's been contrasted in the research with what are called interactive methods. So these come in a variety of different ways, but always, always they have the student being more active in class, actively engaging with the material, and struggling to solve problems on their own.
Sorry, could you, I'm not getting this interactive bit here. Could you give me a few examples?
Sure, absolutely. So the best example at UBC, which has been implemented across disciplines in many, many different classes, is the use of clickers.
Sorry, clickers. For the students that here that don't know it quite yet, what are they?
So the iClicker is that little remote device. You see a bunch of them in the bookstore. That's where you can buy them. So on your little remote device, you have five buttons, A through E. So in class, an instructor would pose a multiple choice question, ask the students to think about it, and click in with their answer.
Oh, yeah, that thing I never did, ever. I mean, to me, come on now. Clickers, they seem like a waste of time. Why would I bother?
Well, the most important thing that clickers do is they get students to be active. They get students to spend time thinking about the material. And that's a lot more than can be said out of most traditional lectures.
Also, just as an engineer, it actually always used to bother me that there was no feedback loop between the professors and the students in class. And there's this really crappy, slow, open feedback loop where the only thing the professor learned about student learning was at midterm and finals. They didn't even mark the homework, so they don't even know what we're getting wrong on the homework.
That's right, the TA always marks the homework.
Yeah, it's actually really frustrating because how is the professor supposed to know what we're thinking and how we're learning? I was actually really excited when I first started to see clickers, betraying my age here, because I knew that it was finally closing the feedback loop, and the professor can know right then and there in lecture if students got it or if they didn't.
I'm just going to say something that I didn't say into the microphone. That's right, the TA always marks the homework.
Okay, so that's cool, but what's the big deal? So what if the professor sees that students aren't learning?
Well, it allows the professor to steer the lecture in a direction that makes sense for student learning. It gives the student, or it gives the professor real-time information on student learning.
Not only that, it actually gets the students thinking about the material, which is really how you learn. You don't learn by hearing material. You learn by thinking about it.
There's also a lot of data that proves that being repeatedly asked questions and lots of assessments and examination improves retention. If you go through your lecture and then a week later answer the homework problem, you haven't remembered what you were taught in lecture. I mean, how many times when you're doing a homework assignment do you have to go through your notes because you remember absolutely nothing that you were taught in lecture? But there's data that shows that if you're asked these questions often and you work through them in lecture and you actually have to think, then you have to spend a lot less time going through your notes again when it's time to do your homework because you've remembered things a lot more easily.
There's actually another little funny nugget here is that people remember more what they got wrong. So it's actually kind of good for you to get things wrong. As long as you thought about it first and you were fairly convinced of your answer and then you saw immediately that it was wrong and then you were told why the right answer was right, students remember that much more than if they get something right on the first try.
Yeah, I completely agree with you guys. I think you hit it on the head with two of the points there, one about the feedback and one how learning happens. So clickers are a really great way for feedback loops to happen in class. The instructor gets feedback about what students are thinking, and the instructor can give the students feedback about what they are thinking. And then the bit about how learning works. Learning is something that happens in a student's head. Most new faculty come in, and they think that teaching is about two things. They think it's about clear presentation, and they think it's about being enthusiastic when they do that. And this is a research study that I'm referencing here.
But it's not.
But it's not.
What? What do you mean?
An instructor can be very clear and very enthusiastic, but if the student's not thinking, not engaging with the material, they're not going to learn it very well.
So it's like me as a radio host. I'm clear and enthusiastic, but no one's listening. Okay.
That may be the case.
Okay. So, but I've got a question about the clickers, though. Aren't you teaching to the question, then? Aren't you encouraging professors to come up with questions and then teaching students how to solve those particular types of questions?
That sounds like a great way to teach for me. As long as you spend time thinking about what questions do we want students to learn, and then isn't that what you should do when you're teaching?
But I would imagine that if you learn to the question, you're learning a certain style of question, and then the moment you change that question, I would expect students not to get it.
Well, that's more what we've been doing traditionally. How much harder is a class where you have no homework before the exam? That's a bigger issue for traditional lecture style, because the way we've always kind of had it is exams and midterms have been based on homework questions. That's a real way to teach the question. We've always had exams just like we've seen our homework assignments. Clicker questions are just prompting you to think in class, prompting you to be engaged and pay attention. They're not. Very rarely are you going to see, or you shouldn't see, exam questions that are just like clicker questions. Clicker questions are primarily meant to give the instructor feedback and to have the students engaged in lecture.
I see. So it's a very more incremental sort of ping of, hey, are you getting it? Ping back, yes, I am, or no.
Exactly. Yeah, that sounds about right. So that's one kind of interactive learning technique. Are there any others?
Well, in physics, we use a few other things. The other tool that we typically use are worksheets in class. So on a worksheet, a lecturer will just kind of pause for a bit. Well, the instructor will pause, but the students won't. The students jump into action and spend a few minutes working out a problem on paper with their peers right then. They spend a few minutes doing that. Some of them struggle. Some of them get it. They talk with each other. They hopefully work toward the solution. And then the instructor pulls the class together and gives them feedback about what they were doing.
Interesting. So I've seen that done in my first year science courses that I've taken every year. Not because I failed, because I enjoy science. And that's cool. I didn't know that was an interactive method of teaching. I thought it was just something to fill the time.
No, absolutely. I think anything that really involves the students, gets them thinking and engaging, is classified under interactive.
I think some students can find clickers and especially the worksheets frustrating because they don't get it as it's happening. How important is it for them to actually not get it? Is that what learning is?
That's certainly an important part about learning, is to help students realize what they do get and what they don't get. And certainly there are benefits to trying something and failing at it, but then getting that feedback that you need to recognize where your misconception is.
Mm. I see. Okay. So it's not enough to know the right answer. It's also beneficial to know the wrong answers.
Yeah. I actually learned a little bit recently about the broader education research. So like educators have been studying education for a lot longer than scientists have been studying education. And to them, learning looks like struggle, like where you actually don't understand for a really long time. And you're like, oh, what is this? And you're gritting your teeth and it's annoying. And that's what learning actually is. It's not understanding for a long time and trying different approaches and coming at it from different angles until you finally do understand. So the process of being frustrated actually can be really good for you.
It takes a lot of work to build the proteins that form long-term memory.
It's not unlike working out.
Oh, very cool.
Absolutely. Learning is really hard work, and that's why also the motivational aspect in class is extremely important. Many instructors probably don't spend enough time thinking about that.
Very cool. Okay, so we got a few different teaching styles here, you know, clickers, worksheets, Sage on the Stage. How do we assess which one's better? I mean, you've said one is the interactive is apparently better, but how do we assess that?
Sure. So the most common way to compare these different methods is really to test students to see what they know. And the way that researchers usually do this is they use established concept inventories, they're called. So these are tests that researchers have spent a lot of time developing. They know how students respond and answer to these questions. They use these tests to gauge what students know when they give them.
So basically, because it's really hard to measure the teaching itself, we measure the learning outcome and then judge the teaching from that?
Yes.
Okay, but that seems like it's got a few flaws there, wouldn't you say, Damien or Tanya?
What makes these different than just taking exam scores, comparing exam scores? Can't you just do that?
Well, exam scores are tough to compare because that's just a series of questions that the instructor just kind of came up with that year. Maybe they took them from a source, maybe they took some from last year's test, but they're not really standardized in any way. In contrast, these concept inventories, they are real research tools. Researchers have worked very hard to develop them. They've used social science research techniques that includes giving the tests to students, interviewing students, having students think aloud while they're taking the tests. So researchers really know everything about these tests. They know when a student selects the right answer, that they understand what they're selecting. They know that the student is interpreting the question correctly. They they know how several different groups of students perform on these.
So these concept inventories are essentially highly refined and polished sets of questions that allow you to accurately measure how students have learned, more so than any old test or exam.
Yeah, absolutely. And importantly, they allow you to compare year over year and from group to group.
So you can give them to a group of students at one institution and then compare how students have learned at a completely different institution with a different instructor.
You can, absolutely. But one caveat, this type of research is hard. It's not like in physics where we can assume Lorentz invariance. We can't we can't say, if we put my classroom on a train and we test them there too, on a train going at 50 kilometers an hour, we can't be sure that they're going to test in the same way.
That's true. You know, it's like basic science research that there are a lot of factors and a lot of things we have to account for.
Yeah, the social sciences are way harder. So this is one way to measure learning. And teaching. Are there any other ways?
There are a couple different ways that you can do it. So a different way, other than asking students what they know, you could ask students what they think about the teacher. So that's the standard student evaluations.
That's the way we've always done it, essentially, with the end of term evaluations.
Are those useful?
They have some use.
I'm just going to go on record and say I never did them, and if I did, it was a joke, and I just wanted to kill some time while listening to someone teach.
I always did them.
So yeah, what do you think, Jared? Like, what's your thoughts on these teaching evaluations?
I think they have very limited use. They can certainly be gamed. I mean, and they often turn into a popularity contest. Yeah. Research has shown that they're completely biased. Just to be frank, if you're white, if you're male, if you're tall, if you have a deep voice, those types of things.
Those will get you a better mark.
Those will get you a better grade.
Huh. Oh man.
Sorry, Tanya, and myself, I guess.
I am white.
And I am not. Okay, so that's cool, and it's also interesting to note that, at least I would say observationally, is that the response rate for those has declined, particularly since we've gone to an online response feedback. So really, I would say it's suspect that we still use those at UBC because if they're biased to begin with, and now we're getting a smaller sample set, like it just feels like a bad news bears all over.
I pretty much agree. I think that it's probably true that someone it's doing well on that student evaluation mm-hmm. is a necessary condition for mm-hmm. being an effective teacher. Mm-hmm. Because if your students hate you and give you bad marks, then you're not doing a very good job on the motivational aspects of teaching. But it's certainly not a sufficient condition.
Mm, fair.
That's really interesting. Do we have any other ways to test teaching and learning?
Yeah, there's a couple other ways. So Carl Wyman has been working on something called the Teaching Practices Inventory. Now, instead of asking students what they know or what they think of teaching, it's asking teachers what they do in the classroom. So this is a tool, a survey that an instructor would go and fill out, and they basically check off boxes to, they say, the practices that they use in the classroom. And then Carl and his researchers have tied all those practices to research results. So instructors can kind of get a score of how well their practices align with research-based best practices.
Wow. I never even thought of that. That's amazing.
So an instructor would go ahead and fill that out for their own class.
For themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But doesn't that introduce some bias?
It certainly could. So there is a danger. If these were actually used for promotion and tenure cases, then there's certainly a danger of people kind of fudging a bit. There's also a danger that people may, on the surface, think they're using some sort of interactive technique, but they may not be implementing it correctly. And so their check on that box probably shouldn't count.
Cool.
Like the bad clicker questions we've all seen.
Like the bad clicker questions.
Yeah. Those suck.
Yeah, fair enough. Sorry, Jared, maybe you can enlighten me here. I've seen some, on occasion near the end of term, some additional people sitting in on my lectures that look like they're working with the university or whatnot. What are they doing? Do you have an idea? Are they?
Yeah, so a final way that you could evaluate teaching is by observing what's happening in the classroom. So that typically happens for tenure cases. The team, the committee that would grant a professor tenure would typically go observe a few of their classes to see how their teaching is. Now, this kind of has the problem that You have to be an expert at teaching and at observing to really see if the teaching is effective in there. So if you don't really know what effective teaching looks like, and you go and try and observe and evaluate if the teaching is effective, that's not going to work very well.
Like, for example, if you're an ineffective teacher yourself. Yeah.
It sounds like this is a pretty hard area. Like, there's no good way to assess anything, really, it sounds like. Or there's a lot of ongoing research.
Absolutely. There's a lot of ongoing research, and there's a lot of sort of non-optimal ways to assess it. But if you take them all together, you could build a pretty good story.
All right. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to Damien and Tanya for joining me in studio. And a special thank you to both Dr. Jared Stang and Dr. Natasha Holmes for joining us and giving us some insight in the field of science education. But don't forget to find us on Facebook or drop us an email at ubcsharingscience@gmail.com. And then tune in next Wednesday at 6 p.m. when we talk, well, politics, actually. Stick around to hear music from our friends over at Innerspace with Christian and Daniel. Later days.